All right, I want to pick up where we left off in the book of Isaiah. We left off in chapter 14. And this chapter 14, a great deal of it needs to be basically coupled with Ezekiel chapter 28, because this gives us some insight that is very, very unique in terms of everything that's written in the Bible. And this is insight that we're given, and it's given about Satan and his fall. And what's interesting about the way that Isaiah words this, when we start to analyze it, break it down, you could see that he's talking about an angelic being, but then he changes gears and he's talking about a human being. And I really do believe that if you put these together, what you're seeing is a situation where Satan is referred to as like the king of Tyre. He's referred to as like the king of Babylon. I mean, in a sense, he's the king of this world. He's the god of this age. But also, when you're talking about this world leader that's coming up, he's referred to as the prince of Tyre. And the two of them, if you can discern, which is talking about an angel and which is talking about this man, but they coupled together because this man is coming upon the scene, obviously, is Satan's man. And so when you pick up at this verse 1 of chapter 14, I'll show you what I'm talking about. It says, when the Lord will have compassion on Jacob and again choose Israel and settle them in their own land, then strangers will join them and attach themselves to the house of Jacob. The peoples will take them along and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel will possess them as an inheritance in the land of the Lord, as male servants and female servants, and they will take their captors captive, and they will rule over their oppressors. And it will be in that day that when the Lord gives you rest from your pain and your turmoil and harsh service in which you have been enslaved, then you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. Now, before we go any further here, what this first three verses has to deal with, it has to deal with Christ's second coming. And he is setting up his millennial kingdom. And he's talking about there will come a time when Israel will be exalted above the nations, and all of their enemies and all of the people who just absolutely hate them will end up being their servants. Look at, for example, the Muslims and basically the Arabs that surround Israel, these nations. Well, there's going to be a remnant of these people at the very end when Christ comes up and sets up his millennial kingdom. But these very people who now despise Israel, they despise the Jews with an absolute infernal contempt, there's coming a day when these people will actually be servants of the Jews when Christ is ruling and reigning. But their servitude is not going to be filled with malice and resentment and hatred. You're not going to see this kind of bad blood that you see today over there in Palestine, especially between the Palestinians and the Jews. What you're going to see there is a remnant that are going to go into the millennial kingdom, and they are going to have a very, let's say, devotion to the Jews, to the point where they're going to recognize that, man, these are God's people. And the book of Zechariah tells us that they're actually going to cling to the Jew and say, hey, man, you're going up to the Lord, let me go up with you, because they're going to see the prominence that the Jew is going to have when Christ is ruling and reigning. Of course, you don't see that today, but you got to ask yourself, well, what's behind all this contempt and all this hatred and all this, just this malice and ill will towards the Jew? And this has happened ever since their inception. Ever since Egypt, you've seen one world leader after another, one tin-horn dictator after another, one Napoleon, one Caesar. Oh, they just have always been persecuting the Jews. And here's the thing. By all the laws of men and nations, the Jews shouldn't even be in existence today. There's no way. If it wasn't for the fact that there's a God, and these are his people, and God has taken them behind the woodshed and beaten them within an inch of their life over and over again because of their rebellion and because of their immorality and because of their idolatry and because of their rebellion against him. He has dealt with them over and over again, but he's always left himself a remnant. But you always got to ask, well, what drives these people? I remember when I was taking a philosophy course in college, and they were talking about the Jews, and they were talking about the concentration camps, and they were talking about all these different things. And there's one thing that just really bugged me that nobody seemed to answer my question, and that was, well, what is it about the Jew that people are so, that they so vilify them? I never could grasp that. I said they have their stereotypes that I don't want to go into, but I'm just simply saying that wouldn't seem to me like be a justification for murdering 6 million in the gas chamber and everything else they've gone through. But then when I became a Christian, I realized, well, it's because there's a demonic spirit behind this. Satan hates all men, and he hates all mankind, and he hates every single nation on earth. because men are made in the image and likeness of God, and so he holds them in utter contempt. But it's the Jew that he really, really despises, and he hates with an infernal malice, because it's through the Jews that God has contacted men, in the sense that he has given us his laws, he's given us his statutes and his ordinances, and he's given to us our Savior. The Savior of the world has come through the Jews. I mean, that's why the Jews have been so hated. Now, you know, after saying all that, pick up with this verse 4, because you're going to see what's really behind this malice towards the Jews, because it says, well, back up to that verse 3, and it will come about in that day that the Lord gives rest from your pain and your turmoil and your harsh service in which you have been enslaved, that you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon and say, how the oppressor has ceased and how fury has ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers, which used to strike the peoples in fury and unceasing strokes, which subdued the nations in anger and unrestrained persecution. The whole land is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into shouts of joy. Even the cypress trees rejoice over you, and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you were laid low, no tree cutter comes up against us. Sheol from beneath is excited over you to meet you when you come. It arouses for you the spirits of the dead and all the leaders of the earth. It raises all the kings of the nations from their thrones. They will all respond and say to you, even you have been made as weak as we. You have become like us. Your pomp and your music and your harps have been brought down to Sheol, or literally hell. Maggots are spread out as your bed beneath you, and worms are your covering. Now, before we go any further, this is a situation where it started out talking about the king of Babylon in that verse 4. And you can make that application, because these kings that have been rulers of nations that have been opposed to God's people and have been instrumental in almost bringing Israel to their total destruction, the Satan's been behind it. But he's talking about here, and from verses 4 through 10 and 11, he's talking about this world king of Babylon, but he's really driven demonically. He's driven by the devil himself. Because if you break this down, the Babylonians came down there and they absolutely overrun the southern tribes of Judah, and they just burned their villages and their cities and their towns, and they pillaged and they plundered and they raped the women and the survivors. They just went off to Babylon as a judgment from God. And here's the thing, that if you look at this, you can see that this goes way beyond Babylon, because look what it says here in verse 7. The whole earth is at rest and quiet. They break forth into shouts of joy. Even the cypress trees rejoice over you and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you were laid low, no tree cutter comes up against us. Now, here's the thing. You go through the Bible and over and over and over again in the scriptures, I mean dozens of times, the Bible refers to cedars, or it refers to trees, or it refers to oaks as being great people, or lofty people, kings, princes, or their rulers, cypresses and oaks. And the trees are referred to as people or nations, this type of thing. Well, it's talking about here a particular time where they'll come upon the earth where everything ceases as far as wars. I mean, look at the wars that we've had. I think there's only been something like 326 years of recorded peace in all of recorded human history. Everybody's at each other's throat somewhere. But there's over 40 wars going on in the world today, and I guarantee you, it's all demonically driven. The epic center of every war is spiritual. So if you look at this verse 7, the whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into shouts of joy. Well, this has never happened yet, right? Ever since the fall. Well, this is going to happen when Satan is bound, because it says this, even the cypress trees, in other words, the lofty, the mighty, rejoice over you in the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you were laid low, no tree cutter comes up against us. In other words, when Christ is ruling and reigning, there's not going to be this situation where one nation devours another over this, because they're demonically driven. And it says, Sheol from beneath is excited over you. That's hell. Sheol from beneath is excited over you to meet you when you come. It arouses for you the spirits of the dead and all the leaders of the earth. It raises all the kings of the nations from their thrones. In other words, when Satan is finally brought low, as well as the Antichrist, all those who are in the realm of the dead, and the dead are the damned, they're going to look at this final fate of this world leader and, of course, Satan himself. And then it says in verse 10, they will respond and say to you, even you have been made as weak as we. You have become like us. Your pomp and your music of your harps have been brought down to Sheol or to hell, and maggots are spread out as your bed beneath you, and worms are your covering. Remember Jesus, when he was describing hell, he says, it's where the fire is not quenched and the worm does not cease. What does he mean by the worm? What's the characteristic for worm? Where he said the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched.
Decay.
Yeah, yeah. It's a constant, never-ending form of death, dying, decay. That's what it's talking about there as far as hell is concerned. And he says in verse 12, he says, now this is where you go from a king, the Babylon, which is really Satan behind this. He's the one that's behind all the world leaders. Now it gives us an insight that we just don't have in other places of Scripture other than what Jesus has told us and what, of course, Ezekiel tells us. He says this in verse 12, how have you fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn? You have been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations. In other words, it just defies understanding how Satan could have fallen. Why? Because he was perfect in wisdom and perfect in beauty. And I really believe this. Now, this is totally speculative on my part. Totally is. But I believe this. Satan was once referred to as Lucifer. He's referred to as the angel that covers. In other words, he was over all of the angels, okay, as far as his authority was concerned. And the Bible tells us he's perfect in wisdom, perfect in beauty. But here's one of the things that an angel, one of the purposes of an angel, and we are told that angels are ministering spirits. So this is speculative on my part. I get the very distinct impression that God, at one point in eternity, told the angels, look, I'm going to create a creature called man, and I'm going to create him in my image and my likeness. And I have created you to minister unto man. Now, I'm sure that when Satan heard that, I think that just really set him off. In other words, he feels like, hey, man, I'm meant to rule and reign. There's no way I'm going to serve these maggots called man. And I believe that was his trump card, because he was able to persuade a third of the angels to throw in their lot with him and to revolt against God. Otherwise, I cannot put it together how he possibly could have got so many angels to side with him. I just don't know how they could have done that. Other than, if Satan was just all puffed up by himself, that's one thing. But to get a third of the angels? Now, we're not told how many angels God created, but what are angels referred to in our physical realm? Maybe I'm asking this question wrong. They're referred to as stars. Okay, Satan took a third of the stars with him. Right? Angels are referred to as stars. Now, this is speculative on my part, too. But we don't know how many stars are out there. They say that there's 100 billion stars in our galaxies, and there's probably more than 100 billion galaxies in our universe. The numbers are just astounding. But I would submit this. I would say that there's a good chance that for every star in the heavens, there is an angel. And if Satan took a third of these angels with him, I mean, we're talking billions and billions and billions of angels that he was managed to persuade to throw in their lot with him. That's speculative, but if you look at that verse 12, it says, how you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You have been cut down to the earth. You have weakened the nations. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, or literally hell, into the recesses of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you, and they will ponder over you, saying, is this the man? Now see the change here, the change of gears? It's going from an angelic being to a man. The two become one. All right, this man is a world leader. This man is coming upon the scenes. This man is known as the beast or the antichrist, the coming world leader. All right, this is the guy that, as a matter of fact, it was Paul who said in 2 Thessalonians, he says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, he refers to this man when he says, he says, for the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. And he's talking about the Holy Spirit taking the church out of the way. And then it says this, Then that lawless one, this is the Antichrist, then that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That is the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence that they might believe what is false, in order that they all might be judged who did not believe the truth but took pleasure in wickedness. So he's talking about a man of lawlessness. He's talking about a man here. But where does this guy's power come from? Paul tells us in Thessalonians, he says, the one whose coming is in according with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs of false wonders. So you go over here, he's talking about an angelic being who has fallen. But he says here, he changes gears, he says in verse 16, well, back up to 15. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you. They will ponder over you, saying, is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a wilderness and overthrew its cities, and who did not allow his prisoners to go home? This is the man, and this is what he's going to do. This man is going to destroy the world. He's going to be responsible for the destruction of this planet. That's what he's talking about here. Then it says in verse 18, all the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb, but you have been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch, clothed with the slain who are pierced with the sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like a trampled corpse. You will not be united with them in burial because you have ruined your country. You have slain your people. May the offspring of evildoers not be mentioned forever. Prepare for his sons a place of slaughter because of the iniquity of their fathers. They must not arise and take possession of the earth and fill the face of the world with cities. I will rise against them, declares the Lord of hosts, and cut off from Babylon's name the survivor's offspring's posterity, declares the Lord. I will also make it a possession for the hedgehog and the swamps of water, and I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord of hosts. So you're seeing an interchange here as far as the man and the angel in this Isaiah chapter 14. But here's the thing I think that's interesting about this man, because he says this in verse 20. He says, all the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb. In other words, all these go throughout history, and almost all of these world leaders have been given a decent burial. But it says here in verse 19, but you have been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch, clothed with the slain, who are pierced with a sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like a trampled corpse. Now, does anybody know what he's saying here about the Antichrist? Well, here's the thing. When the Christ comes back, and we are told, matter of fact, we are told in Habakkuk, we are told that when he returns, in Habakkuk chapter 3, it says that this, when Christ comes back, it says, in your indignation you marched through the earth, in anger you trampled the nations. Now, that's about Christ's second coming. He says, you went forth for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You struck the head of the house of evil to lay him open from neck to thigh. You pierced his own spirit. Okay, now, here's the thing. Habakkuk tells us that when Christ comes back, he's going to slay the Antichrist. He's going to split him wide open from his neck to his thigh. Him along with the false prophet. But Paul says this. Christ is going to slay him with the breath of his mouth. But what's interesting is in Revelation chapter 19, when we read about the second coming of Christ, it says this about the Antichrist. He says this. And the beast, or the Antichrist, was seized, and with him the false prophet, who performed the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast, and whose worshipped his image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire, which burns with brimstone. Here's the thing. Paul says that they're going to be killed. Habakkuk says that Jesus Christ is going to slay them. But then we are told that they are thrown alive into the lake of fire. So this is my take on it, is that Christ is going to slay them with the breath of his mouth. They're going to drop dead right at his feet, but then he's going to resurrect them. They are going to become the first fruits of the resurrection of the damned. And they are going to be thrown into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is separate from hell. They are going to be its only occupants for 1,000 years in this lake of fire. But at the end of the 1,000 years, they're going to be the great white throne judgment. and then all the demons, including hell itself, along with Satan and all the damned souls, are going to be thrown into this lake of fire where these two world's greatest sinners have been there for 1,000 years. So when you read this over here in verse 19, but you have been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch clothed with the slain who are pierced with a sword, who go down to the stone to the pit like a trampled corpse. In other words, this guy is not going to have a proper burial at all. He's going to go alive into the lake of fire with his resurrected body. And verse 20, you will not be united with them in burial because you have ruined your country. Now, what does that mean? You have ruined your country. What country is he talking about?
The earth.
Well, you could apply it to the earth, but what nationality is the Antichrist going to be?
I thought he was Jewish.
He'd have to be a Jew, because Jesus himself said, I have come in my Father's name, and you have rejected me. Another is coming in his own name, and you have accepted him. And as a matter of fact, if you go back to Genesis chapter 49, when Jacob is basically giving a blessing to all of his sons on his deathbed, he said this of Dan. He said, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path that bites the horse's heel so that the rider falls backward. And you wonder, well, what is he talking about there? Well, it's my belief, it's my contention that the Antichrist will be from the tribe of Dan. And Dan means God shall judge. He's going to judge the world through this man. You see, that's not anti-Semitic in any way, shape, or form. It is not. Okay, here's the thing. People got to quit being shallow thinkers and fuzzy thinkers. As Christians, we worship a Jew. It's through the Jews that God has redeemed the world. So it's in no way, shape, or form being anti-Semitic. It's just looking at the facts, looking at the Bible, and the Jews will tell you themselves that their Messiah must be a Jew. Well, they're going to be flim-flammed into believing that the Antichrist is their Messiah. But there's no way they're going to hail him as their Messiah if he's a Gentile. But here's the thing, is that it says you have destroyed your country. That suggests to me that he will be instrumental in the destruction of Israel. But of course, at the last minute, Christ is going to come back and put an end to all this and restore Israel. But I believe that's what it's talking about there. And he says, you have slain your people, may the offspring of evildoers not be mentioned forever. Well, that's what's going to happen. It's Christ is going to put down the wicked, and they're not going to be mentioned anymore. And then it says here, prepare for his sons a place of slaughter because of the iniquity of their fathers. Now, what does that mean? Who are the sons of the Antichrist? Well, it would be all of his followers. He says that they must not arise and take possession of the earth and fill the face of the world with its cities. In other words, we are told, we read it in the 13th chapter, where God said he's going to exterminate the sinners from this world. Now, granted, we're all sinners, so what kind of sinners is he talking about?
Unrepentant
sinners. All right, he says they're not going to take possession of the world or cities. It was Jesus who said that meek will inherit the earth. And obviously, if you don't do away with the wicked, it's just going to be one big gigantic rewind, and we're all going to go right through this again, because you got to deal with the wicked and the wickedness. And verse 22, it says, and I will rise up against them, declares the Lord of hosts, and cut off from Babylon's name the survivors, offsprings, and posterity, declares the Lord. I will also make a possession for the hedgehog in a swamp of water, and I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord. In other words, there's nobody going to inhabit this Babylon that he started talking about up in the very beginning of this, or beginning with that, verse 4 of this particular chapter. But you know, before we go any further, let me just read to you what Ezekiel said in Ezekiel chapter 28 in regards to Satan, because he sheds a little bit more light on this. When he wrote in chapter 28, he said this, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, son of man, say to the leader of Tyre, thus saith the Lord, because your heart is lifted up, and you have said, I am a god, and I sit in the sea of gods, in the heart of the seas, yet you are a man, not God, although you make your heart like the heart of God. Behold, are you wiser than Daniel? There is no secret that is a match for you. By your wisdom and understanding, you have acquired riches for yourself, and acquired gold and silver for your treasures. By your great wisdom, by your trade, you have increased your riches, and your heart is lifted up because of your riches. Now, he's talking here about the coming Antichrist. But the two are interchangeable between Satan and this man, because it's almost as though what you see is that God is interchangeable with Christ. But you see a situation here where this guy is a man, and he's lifted up because we are told in Thessalonians that he is going to exalt himself above every god and every so-called god. So he says in this verse 6 of 28 of Ezekiel, he says, "Therefore thus says the Lord, because you have made your heart like the heart of God, therefore, behold, I will bring strangers upon you, the most ruthless of nations, and they will draw their swords against you, the beauty of your wisdom, and defile your splendor." In other words, it's a judgment that's coming for them. But also, he says this. He says in 28 of Ezekiel, he says, "Again, the word of the Lord came to me, son of man, take up a lamentation over the king of Tyre." Now, here's the thing. If that very first verse that I read, it talked about the leader of Tyre. That's the Antichrist. But here it's talking about the king of Tyre. This would be the devil, because it says here, "Again, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, son of man, take up a lamentation over the king of Tyre and say to him, thus saith the Lord, you had the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty." That's the thing. If he was so filled with wisdom and perfect in beauty, how is it that he could possibly think that he could overthrow God? Well, here's my take on it, and this too is speculative too. But I believe that he was able to persuade a third of the angels to throw in their lot with him because of man. He didn't want to serve man. But here's the thing, too. This is totally speculative. But I believe that he probably got to a point where he just figured, you know, there's some kind of celestial evolution going on here, and eventually I'm going to evolve to become God. I believe that that was his reasoning. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense to me if he was perfect in wisdom, perfect in beauty. I mean, a little child could figure out, well, if God made me, he's got to be greater than me. I mean, that's just elementary. But Satan had to get to a point where his reasoning deceived him, where he just felt like, well, there's some kind of celestial evolution here, and I'm going to evolve. And I believe that he's behind this whole lie of evolution that we see on earth. But I believe it really was originated with him, you know, in eternity. Because it just says here, "You had the seal of perfection, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Precious stones was your covering, the ruby and the topaz and the diamond and the beryl and the onyx and the jasper and the lapis lazuli, the turquoise and the emerald and the gold and the workmanship of your settings and your sockets was in you on the day that you were created. They were prepared. You were the anointed cherub who covers." Now, anointed cherub, you know, he's an angel. He was anointed of God, and he covers, meaning that he's over all of the angels. "And I placed you there. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked in the midst of the stones of the fire. You were blameless in your ways from the day that you were created until unrighteousness was found in you. By the abundance of your trade, you were internally filled with violence and you sinned." Now, the abundance of his trade, I think that it was because of his great responsibility, he got puffed up. And it says that he became internally filled with violence and he sinned. "Therefore, I have cast you as profane from the mountain of God, and I have destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom by reason of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I put you before kings that they may see you. By the multitude of iniquity and the unrighteousness of your trade, you profaned your sanctuaries. Therefore, I have brought fire from the midst of you. It has consumed you, and I have turned you to ashes on the earth in the eyes of all who see you. All who know you among the peoples are appalled at you, and you have become terrified, and you will cease to be forever." So there's a situation there where if you couple with what Isaiah says here with what Ezekiel says in regards to the fall of Satan, it gives us some insight that no other prophet's given us in regards to the Satan. And, you know, this great, magnificent creature that you know, God had created, he's now become the devil. The devil means accuser. He's known as Satan. Satan means opposer. He was once Lucifer. Lucifer means light bearer, but now he's been reduced to this raging lunatic with a criminal mind that just wants to damn every soul he possibly can, despite God. This is what we're dealing with here, because we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but all these spiritual forces of wickedness that are all around us. So anyway, beginning with that verse 24, it says, "The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely, just as I have intended, so it has happened, and just as I have planned it, so it will stand, to break Assyria in my hand, and I will trample him on my mountain. Then his yoke will be removed from them and his burden removed from their shoulders. This is the plan devised against the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out against all the nations. For the Lord of hosts has planned, and who can frustrate it? And as for his stretched out hand, who can turn it back? Now, he's talking about here a situation where the Assyrians were the age-old enemies of God's people too. But he dealt with the Assyrians. And the Assyrians, there's a modern-day Assyrians today, even though the Assyrians have been wiped off the face of the earth. In a sense, these are people who are opposed to God and God's people. And he's going to deal with them. And this is a thing that I think Satan must be the most frustrated creature in the universe, because God's saying here very plainly that he has a plan, and his plan is not going to be thwarted, because that latter part of that verse 24, surely, just as I have intended, so it has happened, and just as I have planned, so it will stand. Nobody can thwart God's plan. And if he determines judgment upon Assyria or any other nation, nobody can stop that. That's what he's talking about. But in that verse 26, this is the plan devised against the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out against all the nations. In other words, it's applying not just to the immediate enemies of God's people, which were the Assyrians and then eventually the Babylonians, but to all nations. God is going to deal with them in judgment. That's what he's talking about here. And he just said that verse 27, for the Lord of hosts has planned, and who can frustrate it? And as for his stretched out hand, who can turn it back? There's no stopping this. God has outlined this plan for all eternity, and nobody can thwart his purposes. But then it goes on and says this, Isaiah says this, in the year that King Ahaz died, this oracle came. In other words, Ahaz died, he died around 715 BC, and that was after the Assyrians had already come down. But this is a burden that was given to Isaiah, and it's a judgment against the Philistines. And the Philistines are the age-old enemies of God's people too. But you will not find a Philistine on the face of the earth today. They've been wiped off the face of the earth. And here's an interesting thing. Sure, the Assyrians came down, and God used them to judge the Philistines, but the Philistines were still a nation. It wasn't until the Babylonians came down, and under Nebuchadnezzar, they completely wiped out the Philistines. Now, like I said, you will not find a Philistine today. However, there are modern-day Philistines. They're all around us. These are the God-haters. These are the ones that are always, always, always strengthen the hands of the wicked and oppose the righteous. There's no question about it. But God was talking about a specific judgment that was going to come upon the Philistines, and it came upon them when Nebuchadnezzar came down there. And this is a situation I think that you can apply spiritually too, because in verse 29 it says, do not rejoice, O Philistia, all of you, because the rod that struck you is broken. From the serpent's root a viper will come out, and its fruit will be a flying serpent. So what he's talking about here is that the Philistines rejoiced when the Assyrians finally got it. And if you remember when we read in Kings and read in Isaiah, or we'll be reading it later on in Isaiah, will be a situation where God used the Assyrians to judge the northern tribes, but when they got down there to the tribe of Judah, that was when Hezekiah was ruling and reigning, and God heard Hezekiah's prayer, and God turned around, and that night the angel of the Lord went through the camp of the Assyrians. He struck 185,000 of them with a plague or something, and they all died, and the king of Assyria went home with his tail between his legs. But it's telling the Philistines here, don't rejoice over that, because there's a judgment still coming for you. And it says here, from the serpent's root a viper will come out, and its fruit will be a flying serpent. In other words, God judged them completely and totally a number of years later under Nebuchadnezzar. They were completely uprooted, and they became non-existent as a people anymore. So in verse 30, those who are most helpless will eat, and the needy will lie down in security, and I will destroy you with famine, and it will kill off your survivors. Wail, O gate, cry, O city, melt away, O Philistia, all of you, for smoke comes from the north, and there is no straggler in his ranks. Now the Babylonians, even though they were from the east, they came down from the north and completely overran them. And then it says here in that verse 32, last verse of this 14, it says, how then will one answer the messengers of a nation that the Lord has founded Zion, that the afflicted of his people will seek refuge in it? And he's talking about here, how will, even look at verse 32, how then will one answer the messengers of a nation? In other words, the message is this to all of the nations, is that God has chosen Israel to be his people. And regardless of what nation comes up against them and what nation tries to destroy them, this is the message to all the nations, that this is God's people, and they're going to be elevated above all the nations regardless of what people do in trying to rid the world of the Jew. Anybody have anything you want to add or share to that at all? You know this chapter 15? It's only 9 verses. Why don't we just quickly go through this and close for tonight. This chapter 15, it deals with Moab. Anybody know who Moab was?
One of the sons of Lot.
Yeah. What's interesting about Moab is this. Go all the way back to Genesis 19. We read about the situation where God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. And in destroying Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot had two daughters who had would-be husbands. In other words, they were engaged to be married to two guys who were in Sodom and Gomorrah. And when Lot woke them up in the middle of the night and said, "Hey man, the Lord's going to destroy the city. Get out of it." They thought he was jesting. They just blew him off as an old coot. They went back to sleep. And so Lot escaped with his daughter and his wife. And then God rains down fire from heaven and utterly destroys Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, Lot's wife ended up turning back. Her heart was really belonged there in Sodom and Gomorrah because she turned back in disobedience to what the angel told her not to do. And so she returned into a pillar of salt. So long story short, Lot ends up living in a cave with his two daughters. And then his daughters feel like, man, there's nobody on earth that's going to have us as wives, and so how are we going to possibly perpetuate our father's name? And that was, of course, very, very important back there then. Well, long story short, they concocted this plan. The older one says to the younger one, "Well, look, we'll get dad drunk tonight and I'll sleep with him, get pregnant, and then we'll get him drunk tomorrow night, you sleep with him, get pregnant." And that's exactly what they did. And the older one gave birth to Moab, and the younger one gave birth to Ammon. But now, here's the thing. Because when we read these 9 verses, it's going to be the destruction of Moab. All right? But here's, you got to keep something in mind. The Moabites were related to God's people. How?
Lot was a nephew of Abraham.
Great. Good. Now, here's the thing, too. Keep this in mind, because there's a powerful spiritual message in regards to today, because even though the Moabites and the Ammonites have been wiped off the face of the map, they've been wiped off this world, you won't find a Moabite or an Ammonite today. But here's the thing, they're all over the place in the church today. The spiritual Moabites, the spiritual Ammonites, and you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 23, this is what God said. "No one of illegitimate birth shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of his descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall enter the assembly of the Lord." Now, what would he mean by the 10th generation?
Long, long time.
In other words, nobody, very few people, put it that way, can really trace their ancestry back 10 generations, can you? I can only go back two at the most, I think. Right? Who can go back 10? In other words, God is saying that never, they will never enter the assembly of the Lord. Who? A person of illegitimate birth. Now, keep this in mind. God has absolutely nothing against an illegitimate child. An illegitimate child can get to heaven. He can accept Christ. He can go to the assembly. He can go to church. All right? But God is speaking in a way here that it has a powerful spiritual message. He's talking about an illegitimate birth, but apply it spiritually, because he said this, "No one of illegitimate birth shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of his descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall enter the assembly of the Lord." Now listen, "No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord, because they did not meet you with food and water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam the son of Beor from Pethroth of Mesopotamia to curse you." Now, here's the thing. The Moabites and the Ammonites in the church today, they are illegitimate in this respect. Jesus said to Nicodemus in chapter 3 of John, he says, "Truly, truly, I say unto you, unless a man become born again, he'll never even see the kingdom of heaven." And this is the situation. We have many, many people in the church today who are not born again, who have not had this born again experience, who are illegitimate. They're in the church. And guess what? These people are usually the ones that are in your face. They're usually the ones that oppose you. These are the ones that will promote abortion. They will promote the entire gay agenda. They will promote premarital sex. They will promote so many things in the church that are an offense to God. But they will claim to having an inheritance. In other words, they will lay claim to being Christian. They will lay claim to be belonging to God, and they're on their way to heaven. But ironically, they are the ones who are always in your face when you try to take a moral stand for God's laws. You see, they're illegitimate in that respect. Just like when Lot's daughters try to contrive an inheritance on their own ingenuity, what did they do? They produced, you know, an offspring that was illegitimate. And this is what happens to people in the church. And you know what Moab means? It means of my father. And here's the thing that I think is interesting, is that apply that spiritually. There might be a lot of people who have been born again, have a born again experience and walking with the Lord, and then they have children that have not had a born again experience, but they're in the church. So I think it's interesting that Moab means of my father, because a lot of people, instead of putting their faith in Christ, they have a religion that they've just inherited from their father instead of a personal relationship with God. Now, I know I've kind of beat that to death, but now God is talking of what's going to happen to Moab. And he's going to judge them and judge them severely because of their wickedness. They had all kinds of false gods and deities. As a matter of fact, they were notorious for offering their children up to certain gods and offering their children in fire to their gods. And God's just going to judge them, because he says there in verse 15, the oracle, or literally the burden. Anybody's Bible say burden? The oracle concerning Moab, or the burden concerning Moab. It's something that's very weighty, very heavy. It says, surely in a night, Ar of Moab is devastated and ruined. Surely in a night, Kir of Moab is devastated and ruined. Now these were Moabite cities. And you know what? You can't see it on a map there because I got that covered up with that chart. But it's below the Dead Sea to the right of Israel, to the, basically the east of Israel. And that's where the Moabites were located. Well, these are the cities and towns of Moab. In verse 2 it says, they have gone up to the temple and to Dibon, even to the high places, to weep. Moab wails over Nebo and Medeba. Everyone's head is bald and every beard is cut off. In their streets they have girded themselves with sackcloth, and on their housetops and in their squares everyone is wailing, dissolved in tears. Heshbon and Eleah also cry out, and their voices is heard all the way to Jahaz. Therefore the armed men of Moab cry aloud. His soul trembles within him. My heart cries out from Moab. His fugitives are as far as Zor and Eglash-Ish-Hi-Uh, for they go up to the ascent, Lohith, weeping. Surely on the road to Horonaim they raise a cry of distress over their ruin. Now it's just talking about these different cities that were going to be destroyed, and a lot of them were destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar when he went down there. But interesting, God is pronouncing judgment upon Moab, and he's describing, or basically listing, all these different cities that are coming under his judgment, and they're going to be wiped out primarily by the Babylonians. But interesting thing, look at that verse 5. It says here, my heart cries out for Moab, his fugitives are as far as Zor. Now, here's the thing. What does that suggest to you about God here when he's pronouncing judgment upon them?
It's not his true heart.
Yeah.
Save and forgive.
Right. In other words, God's holiness, his righteousness is compelling him to bring this tremendous devastation upon these people. But it's not like God delights in doing that at all. On the contrary. I mean, we're told in Ezekiel that God says, I take no delight in the death of the wicked. He takes absolutely no delight in it. I mean, God grieves when souls go to hell. There's no question about it. God grieves when men come under his judgment. He's not out there trying to smash men like a bug every time they do something wrong. No, he really grieves over this. But because of their wickedness, he's absolutely compelled to bring this judgment upon them. So in that verse 6, it says, the waters of Nimrim are desolate. Surely the grass is withered. The tender grass dried out. There is no green thing. Therefore, the abundance which they have acquired and stored up, they carried off over the brook of Arabim. For the cry of distress has gone around the territory of Moab, and its wail goes as far as Eglaim, and its wailing even to Beer Elim. For the waters of Dimon are full of blood. Surely I will bring added woes upon Dimon, a lion upon the fugitives of Moab, upon the remnant of the land. Now, I hate trying to pronounce some of these cities, some of these names, but what's interesting to me is if you just go through them and list every one of their cities that God is going to bring under judgment, you know what that says to me? What is it saying to you? When he goes, in other words, it would have been easy, I think, certainly for me, trying to stumble through these names. It would have been easy if God said, well, he just destroyed Moab, period. But no, he goes to great lengths to list this city, that city, this city, that city. I mean, like I said, you can hardly pronounce this, like Shelish Haiha. What kind of city is that? Or Luhith, or Horon Aim, or Nimrim, or, you know, it just goes on, Eglaim. I mean, I don't think that God put this in here just to make a fool out of me, you know, feeling like I just washed my tongue and I can't do a thing with it. Why do you think he listed all these cities?
And he knows them all?
He's acutely aware of every detail.
Well, here's the thing. What it's saying to me is, look, in their destruction, God is going to leave no stone unturned. There's nobody going to escape. Nobody. Have you ever met a Moabite today? They've been wiped out. Yeah. God is saying here, he listed all these cities to tell us, look, God is going to purge the church completely and totally of its Moabites. And Jesus said it himself, truly, truly, I say it unto you, that unless a man become born again, he won't even see the kingdom in heaven. And that's what a Moabite is in a spiritual sense. You get where I'm coming from? That nobody is going to get to heaven, okay, if they are a Moabite spiritually, or an Ammonite spiritually, or an Edomite spiritually. These are people that lay claim to belong to God, but they are totally opposed to God and opposed to God's people. Anyone have anything you want to add or share?
No.